They say over 99% of species which have ever existed have gone extinct. What if we could bring them all back? We spend a lot of time on the channel talking about the future of humanity and colonizing and terraforming new worlds, or even constructing them from scratch. We generally don't spend too much time on ecology, though. We spent some time talking about energy requirements for growing food for people, but not so much the ecological angles, as I am a physicist, not an ecologist. Our main topic for today is how to resurrect extinct species. And an important aspect of that is where you are going to put them all. Most species did not go extinct in a vacuum. Typically, something else came in that either took over their ecological niche or radically altered it so they could no longer survive. By and large, you can't just reintroduce some extinct species into our own modern environment, as they will either die off again or possibly make something else go extinct. And since virtually every species that ever existed has died off, there's really not room to resurrect them all on Earth. Hence, we need to be thinking about where else to put them. We've got two basic approaches: single species recreation in a zoo environment, or reproducing the entire ecosystem. Recreating some critter means it needs something to eat, ideally whatever it used to eat, but a T-Rex probably can eat cow just fine. Some species are more adaptable than others. Humans are one of the most adaptable species, so you don't need to recreate sub-Saharan Africa from a few million years back in order to recreate humans from that period. On the other hand, some species are much more specialized and highly dependent on their original ecosystem. Generally speaking, the ones that went extinct did so because of dramatic changes to that ecosystem. Some might even need other species that went extinct too, even in a zoo environment. A modern example would be the giant panda, which cannot survive without a specific type of bamboo. Outside of the zoo environment, away from where humans protect them and supply food of the right type and quantity, recreating the original ecosystem might be a necessity for survival, in which case you need to recreate not just that species, but its whole ecosystem, and remove existing species of flora and fauna, and even bacteria, from wherever you create this resurrected ecosystem. Our Audible Book of the Month, Michael Crichton's 1990 novel Jurassic Park, examines this concept, and the 1993 film adaptation brought dinosaurs to the screen in a way that made it one of the most memorable films of its period and spawned a franchise. It wasn't the first fictional work to play with the idea of dinosaurs by any means, but usually we'd found some surviving population of them, like in Arthur Conan Doyle's Lost World. Jurassic Park, though, introduces the idea that we could bring them back instead, and over a quarter of a century later, we are getting close to being able to do this for some extinct species, which raises many related problems and challenges, not to mention ethical dilemmas. Crichton examines many of these in his novel, and you can pick up a free copy of Jurassic Park today, and also get a 30-day free trial of Audible. Just use my link, audible.com/Isaac, or text Isaac to 500-500. Now in that story, the resurrection is all being done on an island to help keep it contained, but that raises two key points to begin with. First, any given island already has an ecosystem, and usually a fairly unique one, so you can't plow one over to introduce a new ecosystem without almost certainly eliminating many species that can be found nowhere else on the planet. So if you don't want to just wipe out some species to replace them with extinct ones, you need to be thinking of putting it someplace new. An island you made, for instance, or one made in a desert or tundra, or even off-planet. Second is the containment approach. Needless to say, this is much easier with single-species zoo method than a replicated ecosystem. A single large creature like a T-Rex, even whole packs of them, pose no real risk to civilization, even if they escaped into the wild. This is not Hollywood, and a T-Rex is not Godzilla. They would be easily located and recaptured, particularly since this is 2018, not 1990. You're not going to spend millions of dollars making a dinosaur and forget to implant a GPS tracking device and health monitors on one. I'd be very surprised if those weren't routine on virtually all zoo animals and pets within a generation, and the concepts we are discussing today aren't happening tomorrow. So resurrected dinosaurs would pose no more threat to civilization as a whole than sharks or crocodiles. And indeed, the large animal that causes the most reported human deaths every year, after other humans, is actually the hippopotamus, averaging about 3,000 of us a year, which is ironic since it's a herbivore, albeit a bad-tempered one. Indeed, deer, horses, and cows each kill more people every year than sharks. It's not the big predators that get us, but the diseases carried by tiny insects. Bites from mosquitoes and tsetse flies kill hundreds of thousands of people each year by passing on diseases like malaria, dengue fever, African sleeping sickness, Zika, Ross River fever, and many others. What additional horrors lurk in extinct ecosystems are unclear, and I, for one, am not keen to find out firsthand. Containment won't work well on critters like that because they are very small and reproduce quickly in massive numbers, and you can't realistically grow each one, so the trick of growing them in some other animal and having them be born sterile probably isn't too realistic. This is another advantage of the zoo approach over the recreated ecosystem. Realistically, we don't have as much interest in recreating extinct insects or bacteria, and both would be nightmares to contain, though we would likely want to bring back a lot of extinct plants, and they can be a serious containment problem too. You could build some nature preserve, artificially heated and lit, down in Antarctica for keeping your dinosaurs in. Any that escape would just freeze to death, and they aren't going to sneak out in a crate or letter sent home. But an insect probably could, and bacteria certainly could, and each of those make up way more total species than all the typical birds and beasts. There are roughly 5,000 mammalian species. There are over 1,000 times as many other species around on the planet. We typically are only interested in the big critters, but that's not a whole ecosystem, just the top few tiers of the food chain. Odds are good you don't need most of the species around when the T-Rex was alive, but you might need some. Generally, an exact duplication won't be viable. We have the expression dead as the dodo for the dodo bird Mauritius, which was hunted to extinction by humans, and the invasive species we introduced a few hundred years back. Now that's not a long time ago, so finding DNA samples is entirely on the table, and indeed we have, damaged though they are. This is where we get our first real trick for doing this. If you happen to find a totally intact strand of DNA, you can take it and find an animal that's sufficiently like it, say a pigeon for a dodo, or an elephant for a woolly mammoth. You take an egg, clear the DNA out, insert the new DNA, and do this many times to ensure success. However, this requires you find a completely intact DNA genome, and also means you just have one, which is quite the genetic bottleneck. It's rather expensive to clone a pet, but there are companies now that do that, not just research it. You send them money and a DNA sample, and they send you the clone of your cat, dog, or horse. Doing it inside a different critter as the parent is trickier, but certainly doable, and down the road we probably could use an entirely artificial womb. That might be preferable anyway, since for many of these it's going to be humans raising generation number one, which is easier said than done for some species. Once you get them re-established, you can continue their normal parenting cycle, but the whooping crane, for instance, can be imprinted onto another whooping crane, learn how to forage for itself, can be taught migration patterns, and how to successfully mate, but 100% of the time the captive raised birds will abandon the nest and their nestlings as soon as they hatch. We actually have to have humans dress up like whooping cranes to raise them, and this has mixed results. More modern, animatronic tools have greater success rate in passing on parenting skills. We can print DNA these days, so you can get a sample that is damaged, and instead of splicing onto related species, you can grab multiple copies and fill in the blanks. And odds are if you can find one partial strand of DNA in a sample, you can find a bunch more. After all, they are all trillions of cells in your body and each has DNA. This doesn't really help us much with things that have been dead for millions of years. It's pretty hard to recover DNA even from a frozen corpse sitting in ice for several thousand years, let alone a fossil, which even nowadays people tend to forget is rock, not bone, and contains no more DNA than a plaster cast made of a footprint you left walking across some mud. The half-life of DNA is about 500 years, in this case meaning the time it takes for half the bonds in a given DNA strand to break, under ideal conditions. The oldest we found is a bit less than a million years old, buried under the ice in Greenland, and we think that's about as old as you can get. Again, though, if you find a sample, odds are it's not a DNA sample, but several million of them. So if you are carefully extracting each one and reading it in, you are getting millions of mostly trashed but otherwise identical DNA strands to look at. Reading DNA has gotten way cheaper in recent years, and needless to say, so has computing power. Take a long sentence as a single line and randomly redact or scramble bits of it, put another below it and do the same, and you can compare the two and make more sense of it. Do this millions of times, and even if most of those lines only have maybe one word left correct, you are going to be able to get that sentence locked down with utter certainty. But at some point it's too degraded even for that, and the hard cap is probably not much over a million years, and certainly far short of 65 million. Humans and chimpanzees share about 95 to 98% of their DNA, and we share 40 to 50% with a fruit fly. You get a lot of DNA from your parents, and most of it is nearly identical, as your parents are much more closely related to each other than we are to chimps. But there are some differences. I can't reconstruct your grandfather's DNA just from yours, because you only have about 25% of his unique DNA in you. However, if he had about 50 kids by 50 different mothers, it should be quite easy to determine his DNA enough to clone him. Let's say we had two guys, not related, Alex and Calvin. Their parents both got divorced and remarried, and so Alex and Calvin share a half-brother, Bill, who himself never had kids, but Alex and Calvin both had a bunch. Bill's subspecies, or clade, went extinct, but we could mostly reassemble it by reconstructing both Alex's and Calvin's DNA, and when it comes to a species, we don't need 100% accuracy. None of us have exactly identical DNA, except for identical twins, and even that's a bit iffy. After all, not even all the DNA in your body is the same. Compare two strands taken from different parts of the body, and there will likely be a few differences. Indeed, most of us have around 100 new mutations to our DNA that aren't from our parents, just bad copying. And that's how mutation and evolution can occur in organisms that just split by mitosis or clone themselves asexually. With enough processing power and samples, you can assemble a pretty decent match of DNA for any organism from its descendants, and in the case of a whole species, we can do this a lot better since we've got a big margin for error, and can potentially reconstruct every extinct species from their cousin's descendants, as we did with Bill. As we catalog more and more species and digitize their DNA, as our computers improve and so does our knowledge of genetics, we could potentially put together a lot of very long extinct species, not from remnants of DNA from preserved corpses, but rather from those remnants of DNA left around in all of us, and the millions of successor species inhabiting the planet. It won't be exact, but that means nothing in terms of species, since they don't have identical DNA to each other anyway. So we're taking the, if it looks like a duck and quacks like a duck, you've succeeded approach. Even so, we aren't even sure if the T-Rex had feathers or not yet, which really screws with our typical image of them as scaly rather than giant chickens. You could get some serious errors if you made the wrong thing and you don't even know it because you've misinterpreted the available data, like if aliens visited a post-apocalyptic Earth and restored us along with Bugs Bunny and Mickey Mouse. And again, we can't overlook things beyond DNA, like behavior or associated organisms, both those inside and out. We'll probably get good enough with DNA in the next century or so to be able to look at the complete DNA genome and model what it should grow into, and that would help us a lot since you can backtrack various modern descendants and cousins to get prior DNA segments until you get something that has that DNA and will look like the original. That might be the best you can do, and you might also have a bunch of basically unrelated but near-identical critters, each with valid claims to be the closest to the original, yet are so different they couldn't interbreed. An important problem arises, though, in that the critter is more than just its DNA. Indeed, humans are basically an ecosystem within an ecosystem. You've got hundreds of species of bacteria just in your guts alone, and the number of bacterial cells in you outnumber your human cells. Many of these bacteria are also symbiotic organisms, meaning we rely on them and vice versa to live, but they're not encoded in our DNA, as they are separate organisms that inhabit our bodies. There's a chance extinct critters could use modern microorganisms, but there may be problems with this that mean we would require the original microorganisms. Remember, though, that we said we did not want to recreate the bacteria and other microfauna and microflora species that would have coexisted with T-Rex because these are almost impossible to contain. If we simply recreate T-Rex without those smaller critters, then there is a good chance that our T-Rex will be short-lived or sick. This is another reason why we would choose not to create an exact copy of a T-Rex. Instead, we would tweak the DNA of T-Rex to use and react to modern bacteria in the same way other modern species do. We might also build in safeguards that would make it impossible for our T-Rex to survive outside of its assigned habitat. That was, of course, one of the plot points in the Jurassic Park series, and, in the stories, it failed spectacularly. I believe, though, that the reality is that we would be able to do that job very effectively and would not make such elementary mistakes. It is something we are doing in labs very effectively even now. The take-home point is, though, that the T-Rex that we create would probably look like the T-Rex of old, but it would be a modernized version and not entirely true to the original. This is less of a problem with more modern extinct species like mammoths who didn't live that long ago and died in cold climates where frozen bodies have been found, or which died out during human history and we've got plenty of samples left over, like something we hunted to extinction for trophies. We also need to tinker less with the DNA to make it work with our current microbial environment. I don't think we can exactly erase that crime of obliterating another species for fun and profit, but odds are pretty good we will be able to bring back everything we actually wiped out in the last couple centuries, and that's something. Of course, we also wiped a lot of them out for living room, and that's what wiped out a majority of those we didn't, and humans are responsible for only a fraction of extinct species. If we genuinely wanted to bring back entire ecosystems, then we would have to destroy other ecosystems that have arisen in the same place as the original ecosystem. We've explored creating a glorified zoo with extinct species, but let's explore the ethics of doing so. The main objections are that you either have to grow them in another distantly related critter, like a mammoth and an elephant, which many feel is unethical, and that you need some place to put them. I've also heard people question if resurrecting dead species in and of itself is unethical, but I've never heard this argument actually detailed as to why it would be wrong to do so. There is a question around what caused the extinction of the dinosaurs. The most popular view is that an asteroid or comet collision 65 million years ago wiped them out. If that is true, then why not give them a chance to live as well, given that their development was cut short by an unfortunate accident, as opposed to classical Darwinian evolution? We speak a lot about the Fermi paradox on this channel, and given that we have not yet encountered any other life forms beyond Earth yet, the dinosaurs are potentially precious as an alternative path life could have taken. While early efforts at this will likely involve gestating extinct species in living cousins, like the mammoth and the elephant, I can't say that this is a moral issue that keeps me up at night. It's a potential serious problem if the mother tries to murder the infant or won't care for it, but we have raised a lot of infant mammals on our own and can probably socialize them well enough to let them return to normal after we've got hundreds of them a few generations down the road. Though this could be a very challenging task, especially if you're not sure what the original behaviors were. It is also a reminder that there is more than just DNA you need to preserve or figure out. You need to know what they ate, so you can restore that too, or cook up something else they could eat instead, as well as what organisms they had inside themselves, like our own gut bacteria, which isn't our DNA. You need to know their behaviors and social structure. You need to know what they can live around without wiping them out or being wiped out by them. We can potentially entirely skip part of that as artificial womb technology improves in the decades to come. And since DNA does freeze pretty well and can be stored digitally, we can't afford to be patient about the actual resurrection itself, even if we probably want to move with great haste in acquiring samples. That passenger pigeon DNA ain't getting any fresher after all. That raises an ethical concern that's arguably a bit fallacious, but at the same time is not. That is, if folks think we can resurrect anything we wipe out, then we might damage our current preservation efforts. You don't need to protect the panda because you can just clone them again down the road. Obviously, that has nothing to do with the ethics of the technology itself, but it is a legitimate concern. Similarly, early attempts especially might result in tons of failures for every success, but that's less an ethical concern with the technology than early efforts to master it. We've also got the concern that if you've got resurrected dinosaurs or woolly mammoths or dodos, people will want to eat them. Indeed, that might be one source of funding, people who want to have a dino burger or a mammoth steak. However, that's the same ethical concern as with any livestock, and this kind of technology is going to run hand in hand with being able to grow meat in a lab that matches natural stuff and is maybe cheaper too, so I don't think it's too valid. I could be biased on that though. I might have been raised by a vegetarian, but I'm not one myself, and a dino burger sounds tempting. But I'd still rather eat a lab-grown burger than one off a living animal, all things being equal, if it was an option. The zoo is almost attainable with our current technology. It does have its ethical problems and technological problems, though. We cannot easily separate the ethical issues from the practical ones. The primary ones of major concern are loss of natural habitat, loss of coexistent species, loss of biodiversity, the loss of the original DNA so the critters can survive in our world, and behavioral issues. We have already spoken about the fact that for an extinct critter to survive in our modern world, it would have to be modernized. That modernization, though, means that the original species is lost, and what is created is a shadow of its former self. We want to avoid these shadows if possible. To do so, we must also recreate all of the critter's original environment, including the microbiological one. Recreating critters costs a lot of time, effort, and money. The problem is that such a species will not be genetically diverse, and to introduce biodiversity into a population will result in a lot of dead-end individuals of that species, leading to the suffering of the dead-end organisms. Despite this, for a species to survive, it will be necessary to develop biodiversity. Again, how can we do this in an ethical way? Almost all pack or horde critters have a social order taught to them by associating with other critters of their species. Many of the extinct species were horde or pack animals, and we can only guess as to what their social behaviors were. Even today, orphaned elephants that grow up without a matriarchal elephant to guide and control them turn into the elephant equivalent of dysfunctional gangsters, and have trouble mating and raising new young. To solve these problems, we are now going to have to move away from the zoo and adopt a more futuristic approach. We speak a lot about simulating our minds on this channel, but what about simulating entire ecosystems? In our future, we might be able to create a simulated ecosystem, and this would allow us to create the necessary microbiological and other coexistent species. Normally, such details are below the threshold likely to be needed for a convincing environment. If you're shooting a TV show in a library, it doesn't matter if the books on the shelves are blank. However, in this case, such details would allow us to fine-tune the environment and see what will survive and what will not, how various behavioral models actually work. Given the necessary computational capability and storage, we can fine-tune the environment of extinct worlds of our past without any chance of damaging our own environment or the environments of other critters we share our world with. We can go even further than that and allow the virtual environments to develop and evolve, eventually hopefully producing a sentient species that we can relate to as well. Given the sheer scale of computational power available to certain supercomputers like the Matryoshka brain we've discussed before, simulating whole biospheres all the way down to the cellular level, even many multitudes of them, would barely register as a minor process to such computational leviathans. And that, of course, is without even considering quantum computing, and running through billions of theoretical mutations or ecosystems to see which are likely to end in something we have nowadays, and thus let us backtrack to the most likely origins. Might be just the kind of process quantum computing is ideal for. Of course, simulating an environment is one thing, but if we really want to allow extinct species to be part of our world, we will also want to move them outside the simulation and back into the real world. Once the digital ecosystem is stable, and we have the necessary biodiversity and a stable social order, we would render the digital system and recreate every detail of the digital ecosystem in reality. Space, of course, is an issue, and channel regulars have probably already guessed where I'm going to suggest we put them, and that's space itself. We often talk about creating new environments for humanity, be it our ecologies down here on Earth or rotating habitats in space, so we can restore Earth to a more pristine state. This might be the backwards approach, especially for extinct species though. You don't move humans off Earth to give Earth back to our cousins, and you don't displace existing ecosystems to put back extinct ones. You build new places for them instead. And while a closed ecosystem needs to be pretty big, it is worth noting that the homeland of the now extinct dodo, Mauritius, is only 2,000 square kilometers, which is fairly parallel to the size of an O'Neill Cylinder space habitat, and a good deal smaller than the McKendry ones we could make if we ever amassed our mass production of graphene. Such places don't have to be 100% closed either, just so long as they are self-enclosed enough that you don't need to bring much in. Assume for the moment that we wanted to replicate every major phase of Earth in the last half billion years since the Cambrian explosion, which is almost certainly impossible without a time machine, but represents our most extreme case. And assume that we needed an entire planet worth of living area for each phase, and said we needed those phases no more than 50,000 years apart. This is probably massive overkill by at least a couple orders of magnitude, but it would mean you would need a whopping 10,000 snapshots of Earth, one every 50,000 years for 500 million years, and a planet for each. And again, that's extreme overkill. 10,000 planets sounds like a lot, but there's almost certainly a billion decently Earth-like planets in the galaxy that could be terraformed to match Earth sufficient for them. After all, Earth has changed a lot in temperature and climate over that time too. And moreover, the Dyson swarms we so often discuss here can give you over a billion Earth's worth of living area just around our own sun. 10,000 planets worth of area is not quite 1% of 1% of either of those, terraformable planets or a Dyson swarm, whereas the protected areas of the United States come in around 14% at the moment, proportionally 1,000 times as much and more. So it's a very tiny portion of the area future civilizations would have, more like a single zoo in an entire country than tons of space given over to nature preserves. And that was our extreme overkill case. Having entire habitats just given over to extinct ecosystems is certainly on the table then, and presumably would help fund ones that were totally locked off from visitors, just science and caretakers who ensured that habitat was safe. More realistically, and in the more near term too, you could create thousands of such cylinder habitat nature preserves just in orbit around Earth, with many thousands more just given over to people and our preferred pets and parasites, without even making a dent in Earth's orbital space. For my part, while I certainly don't want to see Earth turned into some paved-over dystopian nightmare, this does seem like the better path to preserving ecosystems, and even better for restoring extinct ones. Needless to say, it's an expensive pathway that's really only available to civilizations that could build such habitats cheaply, but we've devoted whole episodes to establishing that we probably will be able to do just that down the road. And fortunately, this is something we can approach with some patience, at least so long as we can acquire and preserve that genetic data. But I think it is doable, and I think we will do it too. Amusingly, exactly because it does require tons of manpower and resources. One of our upcoming topics is going to be jobs of the future, and a second look at post-scarcity civilizations and the problems these debatable utopias have. And a big chunk of that is what people do when robots are doing most of the work. Even if you don't need a job to pay the bills and put food on the table, you probably do need one to keep your sanity intact. For that matter, civilizations need folks to have some interdependence on each other to stay together or they might die off, something we'll be examining this spring too, and projects like these offer a potential common purpose and goal when survival is no longer an issue and luxurious comfort might be universal. If you've got billions of people twiddling their thumbs in idle luxury, lacking something to do, and many wanting something to do, something that truly matters that they can feel good about, creating and maintaining millions of habitats to pay penance for our civilization's prior acts of genocide is probably a pretty good pick. You can do a lot worse than being able to look in the mirror every morning and see a creator, guardian, and protector of previously extinct, cute, cuddly critters. so such places might get made even if they aren't a tourist-funded location, because virtual reality turns out to be a cheaper and better alternative in that regard. Easier and safer to go riding around on dinosaurs in virtual reality, after all. That's pretty far ahead, of course, and I suspect we'll be doing de-extinction of some more recently deceased critters sooner than that, and probably on artificial islands in the sea or in deserts or tundras, like in Jurassic Park, which again is our book of the month, sponsored by Audible. Michael Crichton has written a lot of books, and probably had more of them turned into films or TV shows than anyone else, and the most recent being the Westworld TV show based on the earlier film he wrote and directed, which is also set in a park where people visit, though that place seems too big for an island and I half expect it to turn out to be set on a space station as a twist. Crichton is big on those, and I always enjoy his novels for having characters who seem to think things through in a bit more detail, and they don't skip over simple solutions or take forever to figure out things that are obvious to the audience and should be to the experts portrayed. That is something many of the film or TV adaptations do, and the books don't, and why they are worth reading or listening to. The novels are often much better than the films adapted from them, and Jurassic Park was a great film. You can pick up a free copy today, just use my link in the episode's description, audible.com/Isaac, or text Isaac to 500-500 to get a free book and a 30-day free trial, and that book is yours to keep whether you stay on with Audible or not. Jurassic Park is a great book, but if you don't like it, you can swap it out for another at any time. Audiobooks are great for helping you be a better you, whether you want to expand your mind, feel healthier, or get motivated. So with this new year, I encourage you to check out Audible and learn something new. Next week we will be joining Paul Schlito of Curious Droid for a two-part special on missions to Mars, looking first at the history of the missions planned, then moving on to those which have been proposed more recently, and their various strengths and weaknesses. For alerts when those and other episodes come out, make sure to subscribe to the channel. And if you enjoyed this episode, hit the like button and share it with others. Until next time, thanks for watching, and have a great week.